Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The date today is February 5th, 2024, and this is episode 424. I am Mark Ames, co-host of the show, out here in northwestern New York, and I am online with John Dolan, a.k.a. the War Nerd, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in Puglia, Italy. John, how you doing?
Good, good. I was worried that we'd have some noise competition today because it's an early spring here, you know, global warming. Yeah. But there were people on the roofs hammering and welding, and I thought, you know, it's going to be city symphony time, and I don't particularly want that, but they've quit.
Your house is getting... I mean, you guys are setting everything up, right, in your apartment and living-wise. Are you there now? Do you have, like, a desk and stuff? Or
Yeah. Oh, cool. I'm there now. But there's this bedroom that's just, like, unnaturally cold. Maybe there's ghosts. I don't know. That's supposed to be one of the signs. But it certainly has made life interesting for us through the short winter. But we finally got this electric blanket, and what a glorious thing.
Yeah, it's I mean, here I am in what was supposed to be the snowiest city in America, Rochester, and there's literally not a patch of snow on the ground here right now. We had about 1 week of cold snow, real winter. And then it just warmed up and rained and melted all away. And California right now, and I remember this cycle. So California is having this torrential rains, mudslides. Yeah. And I remember when I was a little kid, drought, terrible drought in the 70s, followed by deluge and, you know, floods and mudslides and people dying even. And so there really isn't much of a normal in California weather.
No.
And then I imagine climate change and population just makes it all worse. But
yeah, it's going to amplify it. But the occasional drought, I think, is normal in California.
Yeah. But here, the lack of snow, it's bizarre, really weird. And ominous. Right. So anyway, speaking of ominous, we're going to talk about the widening war in the Red Sea. But we have a great guest. We'll be speaking with Trita Parsi of the Quincy Institute. So this is a really good interview. I think we should just get straight to it. So let's talk to Trita. Okay. We are really excited to have with us Trita Parsi. He's the executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft in Washington. We've previously had some of Trita's colleagues from the Quincy Institute. Anatole Levin has been on the show, and Kelly Vlahos, I think she's with you too, right? She's a good friend of the show.
Of course.
She's been coming on, one of our first guests actually, and she periodically comes on. Everybody likes Kelly here as well. So we're really happy to have you on, Trita. In fact, we wanted to talk to you for a while. And, you know, obviously with everything Iran linked and Iran backed today, you know, now is as good a time as any. I mean, one of your main specialties, of course, is Iran policy, Iran politics, you know, I think your takes on Iran, I mean, they're all very sensible, and probably for that reason, it's been hard. People don't want to hear it a lot in Washington, exactly where you are. So first of all, can you give us some background on, you know, on yourself and your Iran sort of expertise and so on, Iran policy expertise, and what it's been like from your perspective, trying to talk to people in Washington as well?
Sure. First of all, you know, great pleasure to be on. Big fan of what you guys have been doing. So delighted to finally have the opportunity to be here talking to you guys.
Cool.
Yes, I was born in Iran. My family fled right before the revolution. I grew up in Sweden and moved to the U.S. a bit more than 20 years ago now to do my PhD. And I did it on Iranian-Israeli relations, which almost
timely,
no one had
as they
touched.
Say.
Yeah, I'll be frank with you. The way it started off, I was actually going to focus on Afghanistan. I had worked at the Swedish UN mission. I served in the Security Council, worked on Afghanistan when the Taliban took over. So I was quite interested in doing a PhD on the Taliban, which no one talked about, of course, back in 2001, before 9/11.
Right.
I started the PhD program in late August. 2 weeks later, 9/11 happens.
Wow.
And suddenly, everyone in this town, we're an Afghan expert.
So I was like, okay,
this market has been saturated. I need to go and focus on something else.
Yeah.
And Iran and Israel stood out as the next likely big conflict in the region that no one had really deep expertise on. The last book on it had been written like in the 1980s. So I ended up doing that. And that kind of goes to the very heart of the beast because it's a very critical component of U.S.-Iran relations, of course, as well.
That's really interesting. Wow. We could talk a lot about Iran and Afghanistan and obviously Iran and America. I mean, I think John and I have talked a lot on this show about the Iran Revolution and the way that the taking the hostages. I don't think people who weren't alive then quite grasp how much that drove this country really crazy at that time. And there are a lot of grudges still left over from that period in Washington and Langley and the Pentagon and so on, and on the right in general. Today we have you on to talk about, leaving aside the Israel-Gaza war, the Israel war in Gaza, sort of how it's spread, the Biden administration has widened the war in order to make sure they don't widen the war. I've been reading some of your articles for Responsible Statecraft, and then looking back at the record again, you'd almost get this, you'd almost think if you haven't been paying enough attention that that this low level U.S. war with some of these Iraqi-based militia groups or state, semi-state groups that had just started, a couple weeks ago a week ago with the attack on Tower 22. But the first attack, and I'm only talking post Israel invasion of Gaza, the first attack was October 18th by Islamic Resistance in Iraq. And the first attack by the U.S., retaliatory strike with a C-130 gunship, was about a month later in November. So it's actually just been going up and up in stages. And then, of course, it precedes that. So I guess the first thing we want to do is if you could describe, we'll talk about maybe Ansar Allah a little bit later, but if you could describe some of these Iranian-backed, Shia militia groups in Iraq and who they are, and then we'll talk about what their actual relationship is with Iran.
Sure. First of all, I think it's important to recognize that, part of the reason why there's so many militias in Iraq is A, because the Iranians actively have been building them as part of their strategy, but they would never have been able to do so in the first place had it not been for the U.S. invasion of Iraq and essentially the destruction of the Iraqi state. The destruction of the Iraqi state, created the breeding ground that, made it possible for the Iranians to use that strategy, which they have used in other places as well where there were weak states, such as in Lebanon. They would never have been successful in creating Hezbollah in Lebanon if it hadn't started off with a very weak Lebanese state in the first place, then further aggravated by the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, which then created a demand amongst the Shia population in Lebanon for some sort of an organization and some sort of a foreign power that also could help protect them against the Israelis. So you have a large number of them. The Shia ones, of course, have some form of a relationship with Iran. This has been part of Iran's strategy. This is their way of both building deterrence as well as an ability to project power in the region while having some degree of deniable, plausible deniability. And by and large, it's been, you know, successful for them, but it's also come at the expense of almost making it permanent that these states never really get that strong. As long as these militias are around, you're never going to have a really strong Iraqi state or a Lebanese state. So it's taken an opportunity and then essentially cementing that scenario, which I think from a perspective of trying to see greater stability in the region, I mean, this is highly problematic what the Iranians are doing, because it's not a temporary thing. I mean, it's a more permanent thing that they're building up. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, had there not been an invasion, had there not been a continued occupation of Iraq, the Iranians would never have been successful, because mm-hmm. they could do this in reaction to the invasion, to the occupation. I mean, the key goals of these Iraqi militias is to get the United States out of Iraq.
Right.
And people tend to forget, we still have plenty of troops there. Those troops are there for a variety of reasons, but the key reason that is being used over and over again or justified is that they're fighting ISIS, or that they're training the Iraqis to fight ISIS. We're at a point right now in which ISIS has been sufficiently weakened that these mm-hmm. states should and could be able to handle this on their own without permanent U.S. military presence in these countries. Mm-hmm. But for a variety of reasons, we don't want to leave.
Right. Yeah. I was just wondering about a murky moment in Iraq. There must have been a period of cooperation between the United States and Shia militias, like you're mentioning, during the popular mobilization forces, right? I know
against the ISIS, you mean, right?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. I know that Kataib Hezbollah only left the PMF in early 2020, right? So before that, were they cooperating grudgingly as a matter of my enemy, the enemy of my enemy is my friend?
Well, I mean, keep one thing in mind. The U.S. was not excited about working with these Iraqi militias against ISIS. Mm-hmm. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, Lloyd Austin, who at the time, of course, was not Secretary of Defense, testified in Congress on this issue and very strongly said that he would not favor collaborating with them. So what ended up happening was an indirect collaboration in which the coordination was essentially taking place through the Iraqi government. Mm-hmm. And that includes the Iranians, because the Iranians were fighting ISIS. In fact, the Iranians were the first ones to provide weapons to the Iraqi government to fight back against ISIS. It happened much sooner than the U.S. stepped in. Mm-hmm. According to Iraqi officials, it was the Iranians that saved Baghdad from falling to ISIS. Mm-hmm. But neither side had the political appetite to be able to say that they were coordinating openly. But right. indirectly they were, and probably a bit more than that, but neither side could admit it.
Right.
But that was a tactical fight. They had a tactical common enemy. As soon as that was more or less done with, the Iraqi militias went back to their original objective, which is to get the U.S. out of Iraq. And from the Iranian perspective, they obviously want to get the U.S. out, or not just of Iraq, but of Afghanistan and other places, because the U.S. had over the course of decades essentially strategically positioned itself almost entirely around Iran, which of course the Iranians viewed as mm-hmm. a significant threat, mindful of the U.S.'s regime change agenda, which at various times was very explicit.
Mm-hmm. So the main group, as I understand it, okay, is, according to the media, it's Islamic Resistance in Iraq, which is an umbrella group of Iranian-supported Shia militia groups, but it seems to be dominated by Kataib Hezbollah. Is that correct?
It is an umbrella group. There's several different groups within that, and the coordination, I wouldn't be able to tell you exactly right now, you know, where things stand of who is the most dominant at this point.
Okay.
But I think it's important to recognize that we have now clearly seen that the Iranians did a tremendous amount of work to make sure that they were more coordinated and that they had a pretty strong degree of control over them. Mm. And that was through the work of Qasem Soleimani, who Trump assassinated.
Right.
Once he was assassinated, the U.S. itself picked up that the new IRGC head had a much harder time keeping the discipline and keeping these different groups united, coordinated. They had beef with each other. They had different ideas of what strategy and tactics to use, etc. And now we see clearly that many of them have acted in ways that is way more aggressive than I think the Iranians wanted. Mm-hmm. In the sense that the Iranians are playing a long game. They want to get the U.S. out of the region. They want to increase the cost onto the U.S. for staying in the region, but yes, not increase it enough so that the U.S. has strong political pressures to actually deepen its involvement, such as, you know, what we saw with the attack against Tower 22.
Right.
Which now, you know, we have three Americans killed. There's going to have, you know, strong political pressure for retaliation, perhaps even deepening of the U.S.'s profile in the region. And I think one of the key things that happened with Tower 22 is not just that it was Americans who were killed. It was that it took place in Jordan. So, you know, these militias had attacked U.S. bases or U.S. installations in Iraq, in Syria. They had not gone after the bases in Qatar or in Bahrain or in Saudi Arabia. So there was like a quiet understanding of where the delineation of the battlefield. This went outside of that. And I think that was a red line that I don't think the Iranians themselves were happy with at all.
Right.
And the U.S. has picked up that, you know, they don't have that degree of control. And this is one of the side effects of taking out Soleimani, which is that they don't have the same degree of control. And when you have situations such as that in Gaza, that obviously is fueling emotions and anger in the region, that's when the test of the degree of Iran's control of these different militias come into play. And in this case, it appears that this was something that certainly did not have the blessing of the Iranians or the involvement. And there's been a lot of pressure on these groups by the Iranians that they have to scale down. Because again, it goes against Iran's longer strategy. They want to have an attrition with the U.S. that essentially tires the U.S. out and causes it to leave, not escalate this into an open confrontation, because they know that they won't be able to win such a confrontation.
Right.
That reminds me of another question I wanted to ask you. You're in Washington, D.C., a place that seems strange to those of us in other parts of the world.
Oh, it's very strange to us, those of us who live here as well. And if we don't think it's strange, there's something wrong with us.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that's really bizarre about the D.C. environment is maybe not the obsession with vengeance on Iran in itself. Maybe you can understand that in imperial terms. But the weird denial of reality about how you would do that. For example, the obsession with the MEK long after it was discredited in the eyes of almost the rest of the world, it seemed to have a second life in Washington, D.C. So how does that work in the circles of power?
Well, it actually goes back to something you all said in the opening about how, you know, the Iranian Revolution has had a long-standing impact on the United States, and a lot of people are holding grudges. And I think that's true. I do think, however, it is not, you know, it's run out of its own fuel. Other things are happening or done in order to keep that anger alive.
Yes, yes.
Because, I mean, at the end of the day, it was a horrible experience for the United States and certainly for the hostages. And I happen to know some of them, and what was done to them was just, you know, completely wrong. But we're not talking about the Vietnam War where 50,000 Americans got killed. And it seemed, it's interesting how we've managed to get over that.
Yes. Yes.
But not the hostage taking in Tehran. And I'm trying to belittle it. I'm just saying that.
Yes, no, that's a good point.
In and of itself, it shouldn't be able to fuel this degree of anger, particularly in a country that otherwise is known for its inability to remember things particularly well.
Yeah,
that's true. We had no trouble remembering that. I mean,
we were constantly reminded of it. I mean, every time the U.S. and Iran were close to getting a deal on the nuclear side, etc., out of nowhere, there was another documentary about the hostage crisis on TV, or a new one, or a rerun. It just seemed to work like clockwork.
Yeah, trigger that old anger all over again.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, given the fact that there are clear interests, both in the U.S., in the region, as well as in Iran, to keep this enmity alive, because once you had an enmity that goes this long, this is more than 45 years now, or running up to 45 years, it becomes institutionalized. Mm-hmm. People make careers out of thinking about new ways to hurting the other side when an enmity has gone on for so long. So there's self-interest in keeping it in place. And then when it comes to some of the actors in the region, they have, you know, at the end of the day, understandable reasons as to why they don't want to see the U.S. and Iran become friends. I mean, if you take the Israelis, for instance, any improvement of relations between the U.S. and Iran from the Israeli perspective was seen as a strategic threat to Israel, because their calculation was that whatever improvement in relations occurs between the United States and Iran, there will not be a proportionate improvement of relations between Iran and Israel. But it will lead to a situation in which the U.S. is essentially feeling that, okay, one of the key reasons as to why it's kept in the region has now been neutralized, and the U.S. will move on, pivot to Asia, and focus on other things, which then would leave Israel, in their view, abandoned, facing a hostile Iran, but without the automatic and full support of the United States. And as a result, keeping that enmity alive was very important, because it protected Israel from that type of a scenario. So when you have things like this, I think it explains why it's been so difficult to improve the relations between the two countries in a sustained way, why we, you know, keep remembering the hostage crisis as if it was yesterday.
And then the Saudis, of course, but the
Of course, absolutely, definitely.
But things have kind of changed with the Saudis. I mean, I guess we're kind of shifting here to the Yemen war a little bit, but China came, well, I mean, Biden, one of the few good things we've talked about, he had a good first 6 months, relatively speaking, compared to, and then everything went to absolute, you know, the usual hell again and worse. But in those first 6 months, of course, he, you know, delisted or decertified whatever the Houthis as a terrorist group, and, you know, made a little bit of, made some problems in terms of giving the Saudis, basically put on some pressure on the Saudis and the UAE to cut a deal with the Houthis, and the Saudis were clearly ready anyway, because that war was such a disaster for them. But then China came in, actually, and brokered this peace deal between the Saudis and Iran, and that did not seem to go over well in Washington. But it seems to have held up, as far as I can tell, even with what's going on now. I don't know. What can you tell us about that deal and about Saudi and or UAE relations with Iran right now?
I think you're quite right. The deal did not go down well with the United States, because the U.S.'s or Biden's approach has been to get the Saudis as close as possible to the United States and as far away as possible from the Chinese. They view Saudi Arabia as a very critical state when it comes to the longer-term competition, rivalry, confrontation that the U.S. may end up having with the Chinese in this century. And for the Chinese to, for the Saudis to have gone to China and asked for their mediation to resolve tensions with Iran indicated a degree of political closeness to Beijing that I think the administration was uncomfortable with. It also happened at a time in which the JCPOA talks, revival talks, were still going on.
Right.
And anything that kind
That's
of...
That's the Iran deal. I'm sorry to cut you off.
Exactly,
but just for,
yeah, the Iran nuclear deal.
Nuclear deal, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And the administration didn't want to see Saudi or China provide Iran with any pathways that potentially could get them out of the sanctions pressure they were putting on the Iranians, since that would improve the Iranians' negotiating position in the talks.
Right.
So, but also because at the end of the day, the U.S. itself had made a huge mistake. It had no idea what was going on.
Right.
The Iranian National Security Advisor and the Saudi National Security Advisor were both in Beijing for 5 days. And the U.S. intelligence had no idea.
Wow. That's amazing.
And there's a reason for that. And that most likely the biggest chunk of the reason for that is because all our eyes at the time were on Ukraine.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things that you mentioned in passing, but in a way that's alarming to us, I think, is the pervasiveness of the idea that there will be an inevitable war between the United States and China. We did a show about that bizarre book, the Thucydides Trap. So is that view really pervasive?
I think the administration's view is very much that a fundamental tenet, and this is as true for the Democrats as it is for the Republicans, is that either we dominate the Chinese or the Chinese dominate us.
Huh.
There's no intellectual space available to think of pathways towards some form of a peaceful coexistence. Mm. In which we're not dominating them, they're not dominating us, but we're kind of,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And you would think that that would be the obvious path, because that's going to have to be the path we go if we're actually serious about climate change. Because, you know, the idea that we're going to dominate a country of, you know, 1 point whatever billion people is
yeah.
just nonsense.
But what I always think of is the very clever behavior of the United Kingdom during the several decades when the United States was surpassing it in military and industrial capacity. They chose not to enter the Civil War, which was a smart decision. I would guess they probably would have lost if they'd done that. And they chose not to get involved in many, many other mm-hmm. occasions to disrupt the United States. That was very clever, but that example, rather than Thucydides, a much more distant
yeah.
and...
Yeah, and just take a look at the Gaza War, for instance. Mm. The Chinese could have stepped in and just taken full advantage of how isolated the United States is on Gaza to further embarrass it, et cetera, et cetera. And we haven't seen any of that. Of course, they're in the Security Council, so they're going to push for a ceasefire resolution. They were the president of the council in November, so, you know, they have to chair the meetings, et cetera, and decide the agenda. But have we seen the Chinese do anything in particular on this issue to embarrass the U.S.? Certainly not. There's plenty they could have done that they haven't done. I had conversations with Chinese officials immediately after October 7th. And based on the questions they asked, I was left with a strong impression that they were looking for ways in which they could play a diplomatic role in tandem with the United States, not against the United States. Mm-hmm. And I think that reflects a desire on their end to try to signal that, hey, look how well things could work out if the U.S. and China actually partnered on security rather than competed.
Let's pretend for a moment that America is a totally foreign country and we have to understand the American, and by American I mean a very narrow set of people are sort of in the governing and foreign policy class, along, you know, in D.C., greater D.C., the Acela Corridor. They're pretty crazy in a lot of ways. And they can't, I think they genuinely can't imagine or would not be considered credible if you were to say, maybe the Chinese aren't out to dominate us. Maybe they have a different way of viewing power and the world and even empire. Let's pretend that China has, you know, 100 bases, but we have like, what, 800 bases around the world. Mm. Let's pretend China has two, you know.
Like, they have two.
Okay, yeah, you know, outside of their territory. Or, yeah. I mean, they have something in Djibouti, I think, and one or two others. But whatever. I mean, I don't think in Washington you could be considered, as they say, credible if you do not start off with the major premise that obviously China wants to dominate us and the world. And we want to, like, they think like us or something. So,
yeah.
Right? So the problem is kind of fundamental assumptions from the American foreign policy class. And I guess the, because, you know, so how do you talk to them? And how do you?
Well, I think part of the reason why perhaps we theoretically at least should have a better chance to win the argument, precisely because of the reason that you said. We're assuming all states are alike. We're assuming that the only reason the Chinese haven't shown that inclination for global dominance is because they're not there yet.
Yep.
They're showing the inclination for regional dominance. That's how we interpret it. And if they manage to get that, the next natural step is to go for global dominance.
Right.
And to be fair, that's how a lot of states have acted. But also, to be fair, when you take a look at Chinese history, it's actually very fascinating that he has had the position, the opportunity to be way more dominant, and he has not chosen to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can make arguments for both sides. But I think the fact that we have climate change as an existential threat that makes this century very different from previous ones, because never before did humanity face such a common threat that is external to us.
Only in science fiction movies where there's an alien invasion.
Yes, exactly.
Where people always unite, which I always doubt. Like, that's not what would happen.
Well, sometimes they don't unite. I mean, Day of the Dead, you know, all the humanoids, go after each other while the zombies are eating them. So,
but, you know, one would hope that there would be a realization that if we are trying to dominate a country of that size, now, of course, the administration believes it could do so not alone, but essentially with a very tight partnership with Europe, and that Europe and the U.S. combined is a different, it would change the equation quite dramatically. But nevertheless, even if you think it's successful, it wouldn't be successful in the short term. It would take some time to be able to reach that success. And we don't have time. Mm-hmm. We do not have time when it comes to climate change. And the idea that you can have an effective effort against climate while at the same time fighting great power competition, I mean, it's simply nonsensical. But this is where we have the problem. We talk a lot about climate change being an existential threat. We are not acting in any way, shape, or form as if it is. So going back to some of the science fiction movies you mentioned, we're probably in the latter category of those.
Well, that's why I was just genuinely surprised, and maybe that was just wrong, by Biden's or his handlers, whoever really runs things, ferocious reaction to the war in Gaza and their sustained reaction to it. Was that a surprise to you, having worked in D.C.?
I think it's been a surprise to everyone, the degree to which the administration is willing to accept risk and absorb costs to the U.S.'s national interest for the sake of enabling the Israelis to continue to bomb Gaza. I think it's genuinely surprised everyone. The fact that there would be massive support, the fact that there would be some sort of a bear hug at some point early on, I don't think that surprised anyone.
No. I mean, I know how that works with American administrations. They say, now you be careful, and then they wink.
Exactly. But we're talking about two UN Security Council vetoes, a third one that was evaded by watering down the resolution so much, and then at the end of the day, not voting for it anyways. You know, dismissing the International Court of Justice, all of these different things. And now, obviously, of course, the risk of the U.S. itself getting dragged into the war, which from the outset the administration has said it is one of their top priorities. Mm-hmm. That they don't want to see the widening of the war. Yet the strategy they have pursued was not an effective one in terms of maintaining the war contained just to Gaza. And if you listen to what the Democrats themselves are saying, they're saying that Trump is a threat to American democracy. Mm-hmm. And as a result, it's essential that Biden wins the elections because the elections will be about the survival of American democracy. Well, if that is the case, doesn't that make it all the more important that you pursue a policy that doesn't split your Democratic coalition from 2020, that doesn't, aggressively push away Arab Americans in key battleground states, as well as Gen Z and increasingly African American voters as well? What is it in the continued bombing of Gaza that is of such importance to U.S. national security that it warrants and justifies not just the risk of the U.S. getting dragged into the war, but according to you, also American democracy, because that is what you're risking here.
It's amazing. The empire, saving the face for the empire, because it's clear, John and I have talked about this, that the October 7th attack by Hamas was seen as, it's like in a mafia world, this was some upstart, clan that killed some made men, or did something that violated the code. And the U.S. has, at least at Biden's level, because clearly not his base, has had this sense that there must be a big vengeful price of vengeance fueled vengeance, thought through price paid for that in terms of, I don't know, some large number of dead Palestinians to teach a lesson or something. Like, the response has been very much like an imperial mafia hit to reestablish in their eyes deterrence and credibility and, we're the number one power. It's the only thing I can think of. I mean, like you say, I don't see this as if I were to think of kind of objectively what would be in America's national interest or in the empire's interest, but Biden and his people sure as hell think that. But you're saying Biden is even an outlier even within that world, that he's got some particular tick for Israel, and there is that too. Do you know much about that? I mean, there was that Mother Jones article that kind of went deeper into Biden and how much he was influenced by Scoop Jackson, and which is the same Scoop Jackson that influenced Bill Kristol and Richard Perlroth. And
I had been exposed to it, but still, I'm still surprised by how he has handled this.
Yeah.
When I worked on the Hill and I dealt a lot with his staff, I remember talking to, this is a year ago, so this is before Gaza, and it's in regards to the context of the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, mm-hmm. in which a former Senate colleague said that, remember, Biden doesn't need a call from AIPAC. He doesn't need that external pressure.
Right.
He's doing it on his own volition because of his deep, deep convictions and emotional commitments. And this was in the context of how Biden messed up the Iran nuclear deal.
Yeah.
Because the first 10 weeks, instead of actually getting back into the deal right away, as he could have through an executive order, he spent 10 weeks consulting with the Israelis and the Saudis and Emiratis and hoping that he could convince them to go along with the deal. And during that period, the window to go back and closed, because now the Iranians ended up in their political period. And afterwards, of course, we saw the outcome being that the hardliners took the presidency, cheating, right. In my view. It wasn't a fair election. But nevertheless, it was further advanced. Their effort of just pushing out everyone else was further advanced by Biden not going back in, because it profoundly embarrassed the reformists and the centrists, because it showed that Trump was not an aberration.
Right.
Because Biden himself didn't go back in. Right. Actually, the aberration was Obama, because he signed the deal in the first place. But the general American political culture or elite will never do so. And Biden just proved that he's no different from Trump. So we were talking about that And in that context, saying, you know, there didn't need to be any pressure from the Israelis. Biden would have gone in this direction on his own. And now we have Gaza. And I think that further reaffirms that assessment.
That's a really good and grim point, because that was one of the big things that was on Biden's foreign policy list of great restoring America things he was going to do, was that he was going to restore the Iran deal. I mean, everybody kind of come around to agreeing. Oh, as I recall, even the Likud faction was saying, actually, that was a mistake to break that deal, because Iran actually started getting closer to making the bomb, according to some reports. And it didn't help things. It made things worse. Everybody seemed to agree on that. And then Biden comes to power and he did a few things, you know, helped to, you know, did some part in helping to end the war in Yemen, which was absolutely savage. Withdrawing from Afghanistan, but did nothing on the Iran nuclear deal. And that was so surprising, I have to say. And things were getting worse even before the Gaza war. I mean, you wrote about, like, last summer, and I'd forgotten this, that it looked like we were all on our way, on the path to war against Iran last summer, before Gaza, when Biden was sending Marines on vessels in the Persian Gulf. Can you talk a little bit about what was happening there?
Yes, I mean, the administration pursued this path in which, you know, it was more important to get the Israelis to be okay with the nuclear deal than to actually get a nuclear deal. Mm. And part of that was driven because some of the individuals who were in the Obama administration and who are in top positions today in the Biden administration believe that Obama had mishandled the Israelis during the JCPOA talks. That if he had just been a little bit nicer, the Israelis would not have had this very strong opposition to the JCPOA, and Netanyahu would not have attacked the deal and would have not gone to Congress to speak against the American president.
I'm sorry, that's insane.
It is insane.
Like, that's my total wishful thinking.
It is totally insane.
Baby would be like, God, if you were just nice to me, you know, I would have been totally cool with that. Yeah, that's
insane. And don't take it from me. Don't even take it from you. Take it from Ben Rhodes. Look at the podcast he had in December 2020, once he had found out what the strategy was, and he had a podcast in which he said, I plead with you, don't do this. Look it up. Because he said, we tried this. We tried it extensively.
Yeah.
And there was no way you could get the Israelis to agree to this. Going back to what I said earlier on, their definition of how they see their interests, they have no interest in getting any positive deal between the U.S. and Iran, even if it prevents a nuclear program in Iran, a weapons program in Iran. But this administration and these individuals thought they could do better. And they thought that Obama was wrong on this one. And as a result, they messed up the early months of it. And the early months of it was the main critical moment. That's when the window really existed. Everything else after that was going to be really tough. And after that, the Iranians committed a lot of mistakes and made things much more complicated. I think that's absolutely true. And I think the administration did try to correct things and try to get back into the deal. At least Rob Malley did his utmost. But so there's, you know, mistakes and sins committed on both sides there. But the biggest and most crucial one was the one that Biden committed from the outset. And that seems to have been very much driven by a desire of making sure that he could have his cake and eat it too. He could have a JCPOA and he could make the Israelis happy at the same time.
Right. Yeah. One of the strange things about the drive to get Biden back in power, not just Biden himself, but the people who wanted him back in power and who were horrified by Trump, was that Trump was some kind of know-nothing who wasn't interested in the rest of the world, whereas they were very cosmopolitan world tinkerers. And so I don't know. To me, there's been an urge in this administration just to go back to a lot of hands-on tinkering with parts of the world, which rarely works out.
Yeah, and I think there's definitely, again, without mentioning any names, there was a very clear schism in my view. I worked closely with the Obama administration on the nuclear deal. And I felt that, you know, if we had a meeting or a briefing with someone like Ben Rhodes, it was a very different attitude, tone, atmosphere because it was almost like, look, we have a joint problem here. We got to figure this out. And there's almost like a partnership, but of course a rivalry. But there was a keen awareness that perhaps the biggest opponents were not on the other side of the negotiating table. It was those people outside the building throwing stones in and who weren't trying to sabotage the deal.
Right.
So the entire language was more of some sort of a positive sum. How do we make this work? And then at times there were meetings or briefings with folks who back then, you know, we were identifying as the Clinton wing of the White House or the administration, and who are now the dominant people in this administration. Mm. And it was a completely different tone. It's all about coercing the other side. If they don't do this, we will show them.
Right.
Which is not the way, you know, an agreement like this ever would be signed, particularly not if you want it to stay. Because if you want the deal to be kept, you need to make sure that the other side also has a win in it. Right. Because otherwise they will be disincentivized to stick to it, and they will be looking for the first opportunity to cheat.
Yeah.
So that attitude, I think, was very much unusual for the United States as a whole, the one that came with the Obama administration. And now we're kind of back to normal, in which, you know, it's all about us coercing the other side, including countries that at that time we call allies or partners.
Yeah, that's grim. Getting back now, I guess, to the more recent events in the region. So how would you assess, I mean, Biden famously said, you know, peevishly, is the bombing working? No. Will it continue? Yes. And that seems to be the attitude, just ratcheting it up step by step. But I mean, easy question, is it working? Well, I just read just about a couple hours ago, a new report came in. I think the IRI sent a suicide drone attacks on a U.S. base in Syria, I think where the oil fields are. Mm-hmm. So not Tamf, but I think, you know, deeper in where the oil fields are, and killed six of the SDF Kurdish allies who were on the base. And we don't know if any Americans were killed. So like that's not even stopping. I mean, there was a lot of talk like, oh, we hit 85 strikes using B-1Bs and this and that and the other, and that's sending a message. And the Kataib Hezbollah leader said, well, we don't want to upset the Iraqi government, and our friends in Iran want us. And Iran's like, we're not, man, this wasn't us. And so, but like they say things, but nothing's changed. So I guess the question is, like, where does this go, Trita? Where do you think we go with this? Because Biden is of a, as you said, I mean, of an older mindset, where they feel that if they don't establish American, in their minds, American dominance, that the world unravels before their eyes otherwise.
I think we have to recognize that when the administration says that it's not working and we're going to do it anyways, it's an admission, not just that it's not working, and it's an admission, we're not looking for deterrence. Because if the other side is attacking us and we're still going to continue to do it, it's not deterrence we're looking for then. We're looking for degrading their capabilities.
Right.
So that they don't have the capacity of doing it. Right? Yeah. So that's why they go out and say, oh, this is going to be sustained over several weeks. It's still not a war, but apparently we're going to be bombing several countries in the Middle East for several weeks. Mm. Now, but then you have to ask yourself this question. Okay, so if we're not trying to deter them and we're going to try to degrade them, well, then they have every incentive to continue to attack. Right? They're not going to sit there and just be degraded. That's just not going to happen. You know, some folks may on from the blob and say, yeah, but the U.S. has been sitting and taking a lot of blows. Well, first of all, they didn't degrade the U.S. in any way, shape, or form. Secondly, it's not until a week ago or so that they actually killed Americans. And as soon as they did, it changed the game entirely. We've been already killing tons of Houthis and Iraqi militiamen. So, you know, we've blown past those things quite quickly. Mm-hmm. But we're essentially admitting that, you know, they're going to have an incentive to continue to strike, because if they don't use those tools, we're going to destroy those tools anyways.
Right.
So they have every incentive to make this as costly as possible for the United States in order for the U.S. to change course, which then again goes back to the earlier thing I said. So we're aware that this likely can lead to more American troops getting killed. Right. And the president seems to be accepting that risk, again, for the reason of allowing the Israelis to continue to slaughter people in Gaza. This makes no sense.
Insanity.
No.
If U.S. national interest is at the center of our calculation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or even election victory, you know? Yeah. I mean, yeah. Everything is insane. John, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say, the Saudi Air Force has been bombing the same areas and maybe even the same targets, or had been bombing them for years. And they didn't seem to have any attack because no matter what you did, there were apparently hidden supplies of surface-to-surface missiles that could be dug up or...
They got stronger, if anything,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, got stronger. And yeah, so what... The U.S. must have had access to... in fact, the U.S. probably supplied the bombing analyses to the Saudi Air Force.
Right.
Because they were basically clients of ours. They must have known how ineffective a bombing campaign against a very, very poor country, which depended for its victory against Saudi mainly on infantry, intense infantry that just flat out frightened the Saudi army.
Yeah. They know quite well. I mean, and keep in mind, the coalition that was put together initially included France, Spain, and Italy. Once they found out what the plan was, they quit.
That's right. Yeah.
You're on your own.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even that coalition made George W. Bush's coalition of the willing look like quite impressive, right?
I know, yeah. Like the UN.
I mean, this was apparently a neighborhood watch for the Red Sea, and no country from the neighborhood was participating in it.
Yeah.
That says quite a lot.
Yeah.
So, but I think, again, my assessment of what the administration's calculation is that they know that it's not going to work. Because you would essentially have to get the capacity of the Houthis down to 10 to 20%. You know, going down to zero is impossible, but, you know, 10 to 20% perhaps would be sufficient. According to the Israelis themselves, they have not managed to do more than 20% damage on Hamas after everything they've done. And they've dropped more bombs on Gaza in 100 plus days than the U.S. dropped on ISIS in 5 years.
Wow. Yeah.
So we know it's not going to work. I think he's just buying time for the Israelis.
Yes.
To be able to continue to do what they're doing as long as possible. But what's at stake is the lives of American troops. And that's what I find to be completely unacceptable, beyond many other things that are completely unacceptable.
Yeah.
And also, incidentally, take a note of this. So we have these troops. You know, I think most people didn't know that we had troops in Jordan.
Yeah.
But we have troops in Jordan as well.
Yeah.
And then to defend them, we flew bombers from air bases in Georgia in the United States.
Right.
So, but that tells you something. It tells you that if at some point the U.S. actually has a clear reason to militarily strike any of the countries in the Middle East, we don't need to have a single base in the region to do so. We can do it from Georgia.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We're not firing at these other places from these bases in the Middle East. And I think that just further reinforces the perception that they're just sitting ducks.
Mm-hmm. Or tripwires.
Or tripwires.
You know, yeah, in case, yeah. Yeah, I read that King Abdullah didn't, after the attack on Tower 22, it was a top secret base, certainly within Jordan, and he denied the existence of the base initially after it was hit. I guess it was not an open secret within Jordan that there are American troops there.
Well, I think that the problem he's facing is that he has had to use his own military to prevent Jordanians civilian Jordanians to try to get through the border into Israel to attack Israel because they're so upset about what Israel is doing in Gaza. And so I think the Jordanians are in a position in which they do not want to talk about any American presence on their soil because it would potentially be a threat to the U.S. troops there. But also, there's speculation. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's in the Arab media itself, that a lot of the shipments of weapons that have gone to Israel, that they have used in Gaza, has also gone through Arab territory, potentially Jordan. If that were to be true, or if that were to be confirmed, it would create massive problems for the Jordanian government.
Is that one of the reasons you think why they hit, why the IRI hit out at a Jordan base to kind of draw eyeballs to it? I mean, because I hadn't thought of that before. Yeah.
If that is the case, it actually would be a much bigger deliberate escalation. And that, I think, would be quite dangerous if that was actually deliberately so that they wanted to target Jordan. I think another explanation that may be more plausible is that the protection of the bases in Syria, etc., are stronger than they are in Jordan. Because, again, it's not within the geographic area in which there has been some sort of unwritten understanding of that's where the harassment takes place.
Right.
And as a result, it was easier for them to get into the Jordanian base than it was to get into a base in Iraq or in Syria.
Yeah. To your point as well, John was talking about the last episode of somebody he knew who had just been in Qatar, who said that also in Qatar, although, you know, the monarchy officially is acting sort of very neutral on both sides, but the people, he said there was a lot of real palpable anger there, right, John, in a way that hadn't been really, hadn't seen before, whoever was telling you this, anger at America and just anger in general.
Yeah, I mean, I was in Doha as well.
Okay.
In December for the forum. And what I experienced myself, as well as talking to a lot of folks in the region throughout all of this, the anger against the United States is probably higher than it was during the Iraq War.
Wow.
And part of it is because of the great lengths Biden has gone to say that there's absolutely no daylight between him and Israel.
Yes.
I mean, when he attends the war cabinet in Israel, the signal that sends deliberately or undeliberately to the Arab populations is not only that the U.S. is in support of Israel's war, but the U.S. signed off on how that war was conducted.
Right.
Yes. Right. Yes.
And reality is the number of deaths in Gaza in this short period of time is way beyond what it was in Iraq during the U.S. invasion.
Yes.
As well as it was in Syria during the Syrian civil war, I mean, or Afghanistan. I mean, we're talking about, you know, with a factor of 10 almost.
Yeah.
So in that sense, and again, the people in the region are well aware of this because they see this all the time. We don't see any of the images. Yeah. We see a fraction of the images on mainstream media in the United States.
Fewer and fewer. I've noticed that a lot of sites have decided that the big news is over and they're going to do human interest stories or anything.
But I would also say on social media, I'm seeing less of it. And I think that is partly because the Israelis have killed 100 plus journalists.
Yes.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So the actual reporting done by the reporters cannot be done any longer.
Yeah. And you know, if you start reporting, I mean, let's be honest, they're targeting them.
Yeah.
It's pretty clear.
Yeah.
So they'll train a beat on you. You just put out a piece in Time magazine a couple weeks ago, how Biden can stop Houthi missile attacks without risking war. How can it be stopped now?
Same as it was before. Because bottom line is, part of the reason why the administration and even more so the Brits made an explicit argument that what the Houthis are doing has nothing to do with Gaza.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, blatantly false.
Yeah.
Is because if it was connected, then people would say, but hold on, they're asking for a ceasefire. Yeah. Why don't we try a ceasefire before you try military action? Because you have said that military action should only be used as a last resort.
Mm.
And you have not tried a ceasefire. And during the 6 days that there was a ceasefire, which the administration deserves some credit for, but not all in any way, shape, or form, then the Houthis largely stopped. The Iraqi militias completely stopped their attacks.
Right.
So a ceasefire is going to be way more effective, most likely, than what they're doing right now. and a way of making sure that that question is not raised is to say, well, you know, what the Houthis are doing has nothing to do with Gaza, which is completely false.
No, I was just thinking, it seems like one of those scenarios where the king has gone insane. And, what do you do? And we've heard various little stories about low-level grumbling or an attempted fast or demonstrations or a few resignations. Are you hearing that about the inner workings of the Biden administration?
So what I'm hearing increasingly is that the inner circle is on the same page as Biden or giving him information that reinforces it. But even senior officials who have a different view are not getting through to the president.
Mm.
And there is significant, significant dissent, and increasingly so. But it's not reaching the president. And that ultimately is the president's own responsibility and fault.
Yeah. Yeah,
he needs to keep a process so that he actually gets a lot of information. And it appears as if that is not the case.
So another argument I've heard from some people in D.C. as well, if he starts to lean on Netanyahu and the Israelis for a ceasefire or shows a little bit too much sympathy for the thousands of Palestinian children who've been killed, that it will hurt him politically, electorally. I personally don't agree with that, but I'd like to hear what you think. Is that one of the calculations going on, or is this?
It is, but the way I've heard it and seen it is a little bit different.
Okay.
It is a conclusion that they are likely not going to get back the vast majority of the votes that they've already lost.
I see.
Right.
Okay.
And that is probably true.
Yeah.
And if they shift, they risk losing the ones that are supporting his policy.
Right.
And as a result, they're sticking to it. Here's where I think there's a massive flaw in that calculation, because that kind of assumes as if there's two groups, people who support, people who don't support.
Right.
I think the biggest group is the people who are still in the middle and haven't made up their minds. They're probably uncomfortable with it, but it's not enough for them to abandon Biden for a variety of reasons, fear of Trump, etc. If this continues, however, particularly if it leads to the U.S. getting dragged into a war, or more accurately, the U.S. walking into a war because of the strategy, then I think he risks losing a very big chunk of those people in the middle who haven't abandoned him yet.
Right.
So this is where I'm a little bit perplexed by their electoral strategy. There's an overconfidence that people will come back because of fear of Trump, and there's a massive underestimation of what will happen if this escalation continues further.
They learn nothing. I gotta say, they literally learn nothing. It's amazing. Okay, well, you know, that's made us all nice and depressed, which is the point of the show. We've kept you on for a long time, Trita, and we really appreciate you.
My pleasure.
Coming
My
on the
pleasure.
Show. We'd love to have you on again as well. There's always going to be another reason. Anyway, thank you again so much, Trita Parsi. We'll post links, and you should read his articles and follow him on social media. Thanks again for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. Okay, that was our interview with Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. You know, help make some things clear. I mean, it's just it didn't give any hope because things are as bad as it looks like from the outside, from
well,
his more
that's
inside
the thing.
Vantage.
Like, for me, it was like I asked questions like, you know, to me, it seems like Biden's gone crazy.
Yeah.
And I was hoping to say, no, it makes sense in D.C. Yeah.
You don't understand, you know, you outsiders.
But no, Biden has gone crazy.
Yeah, and he's done the classic crazy king thing of surrounded himself with a small coterie of people who will tell him what he wants to hear and reinforce that view.
Yeah, that explains why when he got heckled at a couple of those meetings, he had that blinking in the headlights look like Ceausescu had just before they dragged him out and shot him.
Yeah. Like, this can't be happening. And, you know, and of course, as we found out, it's Russian disinformation caused that.
Yeah.
And go back to China, I think is what Pelosi said to some of them. And So the Democrats have
that's
learned.
Her skill.
Tact, and they've learned from 2000. They're not going to let 2016 repeat again, God knows. That's the other big takeaway. Like, they're just, they learn nothing. They learn nothing and forget nothing, as they say. Yeah. But anyway, all right, on that wretched note, I think we can end the show today. Thanks again to Charita Parsi, and thank you, everyone. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, everybody. Okay, bye.
Bye.